It's always seemed to me, turning to another sport, that the appeal of running is that all you need is a good pair of shoes and a stretch of open road. But like everything else in our lives, this most basic sport has gone high tech. Go out for a jog these days, and your GPS watch will constantly update your pace and distance. And now smartphones with built-in GPS have gotten into the game, offering lots of new tools to runners. We asked NPR's Tamara Keith to take a couple of these programs for a spin.
I'm a runner. Not a good one, not a fast one, just a runner. And I'm a total gearhead. I'm the person you see coming down the trail with a GPS wristwatch on one arm, an MP3 player on the other, water bottles strapped around my waist, and compression socks pulled up to my knees. I realize this is super geeky, but I love to know precisely how fast I'm going. And if my GPS says I've only gone 5.95 miles, I'll run up and down my driveway to get it up to 6. So, of course, one of the first things I did when I got my new iPhone was install a bunch of running-related apps. Runkeeper, iMap My Run, the Nike Plus app, and one from Adidas called My Coach.
Begin workout. Blue Zone. 5 minutes.
With My Coach, you set up a training plan online. Then the app guides you through your runs with voice cues.
So it says to start out slow. So we'll start out slow.
Today's workout is an interval run with a couple of 5-minute fast-paced intervals.
Speed up to yellow zone, 5 minutes.
I'm wearing my Garmin GPS watch, too, to see how they compare.
Speed up to yellow zone.
It doesn't believe me. I'm going faster. So my Garmin says I'm doing a 9:15 pace. And my phone says I'm doing a 9:36 pace. And this is the problem with having too much information at your fingertips.
And so it goes, with the phone telling me to speed up and slow down until the workout is complete.
Great job. Time, 35 minutes. Calories, 365.
Like all of these apps, My Coach allows you to check your stats, see the run on a map, tweet your results, and upload the data to the web. They all cost less than $10 and have slightly different bells and whistles. David Willey is the editor-in-chief of Runner's World magazine. He regularly uses iMap My Run and Runkeeper.
I've actually gotten quite addicted to the data and the specific information that I can get in real time and then sort of play with after my run.
He says in the past, only very serious or elite professional runners got this kind of coaching and detailed information. Now anyone can.
There are probably more runners that are out there training smarter than there ever have been because of technology and the sort of democratization of technology.
And then there are people like Rich Cohen.
It's nice to just go out there with your watch and just enjoy the outdoors and enjoy the nice weather and the people running around you and maybe some of the scenes.
And when he says watch, he's not talking about one with a built-in GPS, just a plain old watch, so he knows what time it is. Rich and I run together when he wants to take it slow. And I get the sense that he thinks all my gear and technology are silly.
If I want to run 6 miles, I'll go for about 45 minutes. If I feel like I'm going a little slower, I might add on a few minutes. I don't feel a need to say, I'm going out at 7:30 a mile. I need to run 7:30 a mile for 6 miles to feel like I accomplished what I was trying to do that day.
But if you do want to know exactly how far and exactly how fast you went, there are now plenty of options. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
And you'll find a summary of running apps on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
We're talking this week about some of the questions raised by the prospect of cyber war, computers fighting computers. It turns out the questions are very similar in some ways to the questions raised by conventional war. What's fair? What's not? What is legal under the laws of war? What is a war crime? NPR's Tom Gelton is our guide through this subject and joins us once again. Tom, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Now, you suggested yesterday that the United States wants to find some way to apply the laws of war to cyberspace. There's also a question we're going to consider this morning, which is, I guess, disarmament. The U.S. tries to get countries to give up nuclear weapons. They also want to try to get countries to give up their hackers and evil computer programs?
Well, actually, Steve, there's a little bit of a paradox here. You're right. The U.S. government is essentially in favor of applying the law of war to a cyber conflict, but it has long been opposed to the idea of cyber arms control.
Why?
A big reason is because of the way cyber disarmament has been framed. Governments have very different ideas of what a cyber weapon is, and therefore they have different ideas of what disarmament should involve. We can begin with what's happening at the International Telecommunications Union. It's actually a United Nations agency, probably best known these days for its supervision of international telephone calls. You know, it's the ITU that came up with country codes. Mm-hmm. But in a meeting last fall, the ITU Secretary General Hamadoun Touré let it be known he wanted his organization to take on a new problem, cyber war.
As you well know, the next world war could happen in the cyberspace. And that will be a catastrophe.
Actually, we don't know for sure what a cyber war would be like because we've never really had one. But Mr. Touré thinks the ITU could keep one from happening.
We need to make sure that by the end of next year, we broker a global agreement in which every country commits itself not to attack another country first.
The International Telecommunications Union as the broker of a worldwide cyber peace agreement. May sound like another wacky UN idea, but there's more to it, Steve. Behind this notion of a cyber peace negotiation is a high-stakes battle over no less than the future of the Internet itself, because the countries most eager to see a cyber peace treaty have their own idea of what cyber war might mean.
Well, let me make sure I understand that, Tom Gelton, because it seems pretty straightforward. If you talk about cyber war, you can talk about hacking, destroying computer systems remotely, knocking down power grids and so forth. What other definition of cyber war is there?
Well, let's go back to 1998. At the UN that year, Russia proposed a global disarmament agreement applying to cyberspace. But the Russians were not focused on stopping sneak attacks on computer networks. They were talking about the need for information security. They worried the Internet was making it so easy for people to communicate that a government could use the Internet to start a battle of ideas and challenge another country's political system. The Russians actually revived an old Soviet term, ideological aggression. At a UN conference in 2008, Sergei Korotkov of the Russian Defense Ministry argued that any time a government promotes ideas on the Internet with the goal of subverting another country's government, even in the name of democracy, it should qualify as aggression that would make it illegal under the UN Charter. He spoke through an interpreter.
Practically any information operation conducted by a state or a number of states against another state would be qualified as an interference into internal affairs. So any good cause like promotion of democracy cannot be used as a justification for such actions.
And this is what the Russians would like to see in a cyber arms control agreement. Limits on what ideas governments allow on the Internet. And they're not alone. James Lewis of the Center for Strategic and International Studies has served as a consultant to the UN Disarmament Institute. In his work there, he has seen firsthand how many governments share the Russian view.
The thing that really unites them is their desire to control information, to control content. And so they see information as a weapon. An official from one of those countries told me, Twitter is an American plot to destabilize foreign governments. That's what they think. And so they're asking, how do we get laws that control the information weapon?
The Russians have introduced their cyber disarmament proposal at the UN each year since 1998. Last year, they got an even sharper version approved by the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which includes China and four Central Asian countries, as well as Russia. The accord defined information war in part as an effort by a state to undermine another's political, economic, and social systems. It actually used the term mass psychological brainwashing.
So what we might think of as a battle of ideas, they're arguing, is something insidious, evil, warlike.
Right. And U.S. diplomats think the Russians see that Shanghai Accord that they negotiated last year as a blueprint for exactly the kind of cyber arms control agreement they would want from the U.N. But getting information controls on the Internet would first require changes in the way the Internet is governed. Right now, nobody really governs it. And this is what brings us back to the International Telecommunications Union and the notion that it could broker a cyber peace treaty. There's now a push within the ITU membership, supported by the leadership, to give developing countries a bigger voice in decisions about how the Internet works, partly in the name of cyber peace. James Lewis says some powerful countries would support such a move. They are ready to put the Internet under more government control.
India feels this way. Brazil feels this way. China feels this way. They want a bigger role for government.
The changing international lineup on this issue of Internet governance is in keeping with other geopolitical trends, says Harvard Law professor Jack Goldsmith, just as the global economy is being redefined by the emerging economic powers, so now is the Internet.
How could it be any other way? This is a hugely important, consequential political, social, and economic tool. And powerful nations are going to try to wield it and shape it to reflect their interests. The network will increasingly, I fear, look like what they want it to look like.
The United States, Steve, is actually trying to work with Russia and other countries to establish some norms of appropriate government behavior in cyberspace, no controls on information. But, Steve, the bottom line here is there is a growing feeling that the United States, having invented the Internet, has been able to use it as a weapon against its adversaries. And the next time you hear about the need for cyber arms control, be aware there's another story behind it.
Meaning that the different ideas of what arms control means in cyberspace is going to complicate any effort to do anything about it.
Yes, because we think of cyber war as attacking computer networks. Many other countries see it entirely in political terms.
Which is how Iran, for example, would see this, I suppose.
To the government of Iran, cyber war means giving dissidents the power to communicate via Twitter. And Steve, with all these differences in views of what cyber conflict involves, you can be sure it will take a while to work out any new rules that would apply in this domain.
Tom, always a pleasure to see you.
Good to see you, Steve.
NPR's Tom Gelton.
This is NPR News.
This week, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg seems as ubiquitous as the social network that he founded. Forbes magazine ranked him as the 35th wealthiest American with a net worth of $6.9 billion. Today, he appears on the Oprah Winfrey Show to announce a $100 million gift to public schools in Newark, New Jersey. And next week, a new movie, The Social Network, comes out depicting the creation of Facebook. NPR's David Folkenflik is wondering about the connection between these events.
Not to dismiss the importance of Zuckerberg's gift, and other reporters are covering that for us, but how better to change the subject than with a nine-figure philanthropic gesture? In the movie version of his life, Zuckerberg is portrayed as unscrupulous en route to his billions and, despite his service based on friending and likes, utterly unable to connect to others. Jesse Eisenberg plays Zuckerberg, here appealing to a friend.
I need you. I'm here for you. No, I need the algorithm used to rank chess players.
Are you okay?
We're ranking girls.
You mean other students?
Yeah.
You think this is such a good idea?
I need the algorithm.
Mark.
I need the algorithm.
Showing up to talk on Oprah is Image Rehab 101, but it could misfire. Here's what happened when Leslie Stahl compared Zuckerberg to the founders of Google.
You seem to be replacing Larry and Sergey as the people out here who everyone's talking about. You're just staring at
me. Is that a question?
The real question is how much he'll be remembered as an online entrepreneur and philanthropist, and how much for the movie version of his rise. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Paul Rayburn, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Earlier this year, scientists built the most precise clock on Earth, an aluminum ion clock. Now, don't try this at home with a roll of aluminum foil. It's not going to work. These are among the most precise clocks ever built. And now researchers have used a pair of these clocks to test Einstein's theory of relativity at a very, very tiny scale. They've been able to measure the minuscule changes in time that occur when you are sitting in a moving car or standing at the top of a staircase. The research appears this week in the journal Science. But what's so important about measuring time so precisely? Testing Einstein's theory of relativity is good sport, and it has been for decades now, a century. But is it really worth all the time and trouble? Let's just give Einstein a break from all this testing and retesting. Or maybe we can learn something else from these clocks that even a Rolex would never tell us. We're about to find out. Joining me now is Tom O'Brien, Chief of the Time and Frequency Division, I love that title, at the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Paul.
How are you? Nice to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
If you have questions, give us a call. Questions for me or for Tom. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet us your questions. Our account is at SciFry. If you want to know more about what we're discussing this hour, go to our website, sciencefriday.com, where you will find all kinds of links. So, Tom, give us a little refresher on the theory of relativity, if you can, and what role time plays in that.
Well, Einstein developed the theory of relativity, and one way of looking at it is to say space and time are not really separate but are intertwined. And he expressed that in two different ways. The special theory of relativity, one way of looking at it is to say when a clock is moving, it appears to tick more slowly than a clock that's standing still. And the general theory of relativity has to do with the effect of gravity on space and time. And one way of looking at it, it says that the stronger the gravitational field is, the slower the clock ticks. So basically, if you're moving really fast, close to the speed of light, you can see significant changes in the ticking rate of a clock. Or if you're in a very strong gravitational field, like near a black hole or something like that, you can see a significant change in the ticking rate of a clock. What happened in this experiment at NIST was that the scientists made a clock that is so accurate and so precise that instead of having to go at close to warp speed or something like that or be near a black hole, you can actually see the change in the ticking rate of the clock just by lifting the clock up about a foot or by making the ion, which is the ticking part of the clock, just move at even walking or jogging speed.
So you guys were showing off is what it comes down to here.
That's right. I mean, at NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, part of our job is to make the best measurements possible, but it's not just to get the next decimal place or just for fun. The measurements that we make affect people's lives every day, and for example, very accurate timing. I mean, do you need to be able to measure the time change on your watch that's going to be caused by you walking? Well, no, your watch isn't going to measure that. It's not going to make any practical difference in your life. But very accurate timing and synchronization is a part of our modern technological infrastructure, and people are using it every day. When you make a telephone call, when you use a computer network, you're relying on networks that have to be synchronized to better than a millionth of a second per day. Electric power distribution has to be synchronized to better than a millionth of a second per day. And the global positioning system, GPS, which allows you to get your position anywhere on Earth while you're driving or walking around with a handheld receiver or while an airline pilot is flying, that relies on atomic clocks that are better than a billionth of a second per day.
Okay, now, I mentioned in the introduction, we seem to be hearing about Tessa Einstein all over the place, all the time. The poor guy, let's give him a break. And why do we keep testing Einstein? Is it fun? Is it real? What's going on here?
We would have been very surprised, perhaps shocked, if we had found a departure from Einstein's theory of relativity in these measurements. But you never do know. I think it is valuable in and of itself to keep pushing the extremes of measurement because many of the things that we take for granted today in science and in technology, in fact, came about by somebody trying to push for that one more decimal place and finding something very unusual or exciting. While Einstein himself developed a lot of the theory of relativity just through his mental powers, his very prodigious mental powers, it was in fact based on precision experiments which were looking at things called the ether, which was some mythical substance through which light was supposed to propagate. And when it was discovered by measurements in the late 1800s that in fact this ether did not appear to exist, people had to come up with other theories to explain what's really going on. And that led directly and indirectly to Einstein developing his theory. And things like the discovery of quantum mechanics, which governs everything from electronics to even the way we're looking at biophysics nowadays, again, came about through very precise measurements showing things that were behaving just a little bit differently than expected and then pursuing those measurements.
Now, are there? You talked a little bit about GPS and other sensitive measurements we need. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about that. What are the potential practical applications from this kind of work?
Well, for any of those things that I mentioned, such as telecommunications, distribution of electric power, more precise positioning with GPS, having better clocks will make all those things better. You might be able to pump more calls onto a limited amount of capacity if you have better timing. The way you do that is by breaking up the calls into little pieces, sending different pieces at different times, and synchronizing those sending very accurately so that you can keep the call. A global positioning system, of course, basically relies on timing very precisely how long it takes a radio signal from the GPS satellite traveling at the speed of light to reach you from different satellites. Since that speed is roughly 1 foot and 1 billionth of a second, the more accurately you can measure time, the more precisely you can get your location. But actually what I think is going to be the major applications for clocks like this aluminum-ion clock, which was part of the relativity experiment, and similar clocks that NIST and other organizations are working on, are not necessarily to measure time directly, but to measure other quantities. So by looking at the ticking rate changing by having the clock moved up just 1 foot, basically what you're doing is measuring the change in gravity. And right now, people try to measure changes in gravity for everything from looking for minerals under the ground. For example, oil is less dense than rock, so there's a very slight reduction in gravity if you happen to be above a source of water or oil or other minerals, and you can detect that without having to dig holes down deep into the Earth. Just measuring the very small changes in the Earth itself that result from everything from climate change, from changes in the amount of ice that there is, which pushes down on the Earth's crust, to just how the Earth is changing in general. Those are important measurements. And the ticking rate of atomic clocks can also be affected by things such as the magnetic fields. Typically, in most atomic clocks, what we try to do is shield out the magnetic field so it doesn't affect the ticking rate, so we get the best time measurement possible. But if you let the magnetic field come in, it becomes a very sensitive magnetometer. And in fact, not with the aluminum ion clock, but with other atomic clocks we have here at NIST, some of the scientists have even done things like measured the magnetic fields that are generated by the heart and brain activity of a mouse. Now, again, you might say, well, what's the deal with that? This might be a whole new way of medical imaging, of getting information about normal physiological processes and disease states. Right now, people measure the electrical fields from the heart activity and brain activity. Those are electrocardiograms and electroencephalograms. But sometimes that electrical information has a hard time getting out of the human body because the human body does have some electrical conductivity.
All right. Tom, we're going to have to run. We're just about out of time. But fascinating stuff. Congratulations on the new achievement. And the lesson I take from this, I think, is that those people who live in the penthouse at the top of my building are going to get older faster than I am. So there's some satisfaction in that. How am I doing? Is that right?
Well, that's basically right.
Okay. Our guest has been Tom O'Brien, Chief of the Time and Frequency Division at the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Good to talk to you.
Last year, more than 5,000 highway deaths were attributed to distracted driving. This weekend, highway safety officials from each of the 50 states are meeting in Kansas City. Among the items on their agenda is whether to recommend banning all cell phone use by drivers. That would include handheld and hands-free devices. The proposal comes after Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood held the second Distracted Driving Summit in Washington this past week. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
I'm standing on a busy street corner in Washington, D.C., actually just down the block from NPR's headquarters. But just to prove the point, you don't need to go very far to find someone driving and talking on a cell phone at the same time. There's a guy over there in a Volvo, one hand on the wheel, the other on his cell phone. A woman trying to make a left-hand turn through this crosswalk. Her cell phone is in her hand.
This is in a city where handheld cell phone use is already against the law. The Governor's Highway Safety Association is considering a further step proposing banning all cell phone use. Jonathan Adkins is a spokesman for the GHSA.
I think it's prompted by the concern that regardless of the law in any state, any type of cell phone use while driving is dangerous. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety and Carnegie Mellon University and a whole host of other entities have shown that just because you're hands-free, there's no safety benefit to that.
Adoption of the resolution by the Highway Safety Group wouldn't be binding. Each state legislature would need to act. But there's clearly some momentum behind the notion of banning or restricting cell phone use in cars. 8 states and the District of Columbia now ban handheld cell phone use. 30 states ban texting while driving. Automakers say they're doing what they can to keep drivers' hands on the wheel. Louis Tiarina is a senior technical specialist with Ford. He says the company's onboard computer system called Sync is aimed at helping drivers avoid fiddling with navigation and music systems.
Instead of having to key in a destination, you can speak a destination. Instead of trying to find a specific song on your iPod by turning the thumb wheel, you simply speak it. Instead of trying to scroll down to a particular person in your phone book, you simply state the person's name.
Similar systems are offered by other automakers. The industry is lobbying against outlawing hands-free cell phone use. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, who has made distracted driving his signature issue, mused to reporters this past week that perhaps cell phone boxes should carry warning labels similar to cigarette packages. And he also called out automakers for offering technology that LaHood says distracts drivers.
In recent days and weeks, we've seen news stories about car makers adding technology in vehicles that lets drivers update Facebook, surf the web, or do any other number of things instead of driving safely. But facts are facts. Features that pull drivers' hands and eyes and attention away from the road are distractions, period.
Advocates of the bans are also fighting another battle. Studies in 2 states have shown when such bans are actively enforced by police, cell phone use declines. But many states lack the resources to actively enforce a cell phone ban. Legislation before Congress would provide states more funding, but it's unlikely to come to a vote in the remainder of this session. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The FBI and local law enforcement officials say the rapid development of new technology is hurting their ability to investigate and solve crimes. So they're asking the White House and Congress to change the law to make it easier to get their hands on electronic conversations. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports on the start of what could be a long legislative fight.
You know those popular messaging tools like BlackBerry, Skype, and Facebook? Law enforcement says that criminals are using them to keep in touch, too. Peter Modafferi is chief of detectives in the Rockland County District Attorney's Office in New York. He worries that new technology is leaving police in the dark.
As technology changed and we weren't able to keep up with it, or are limited in how we can keep up with it, we're losing our ability to see the evidence that we need to see.
Here's the problem. The 1994 Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which governs how authorities deal with telephone companies and internet service providers, doesn't address the government's ability to get messages on newer social networking sites or from foreign companies that market devices such as BlackBerry and services such as Skype. Here's Modafferi.
The 21st century law enforcement officer or prosecutor has to look to the digital world for electronic evidence.
Oftentimes, the FBI says, companies want to comply with law enforcement requests, but they don't have an easy way to unscramble messages and turn them over right away. So the FBI has to send in its own team to do just that, which eats up more time and government resources in sensitive cases. Jamil Jaffer worked at the Justice Department's National Security Division in the Bush administration.
The spectrum of threats, both from cyber criminals, child predators on the internet, and terrorists is only increasing. And so everybody needs to think very carefully about the increasing threat spectrum when considering how to change the law.
The proposal is in the early stages. It's being discussed at the White House, the Justice Department, and other government agencies. But it's already provoking a lot of conversation among privacy advocates. Jim Dempsey works at the Center for Democracy and Technology, an internet privacy group. He says the FBI's already swimming in data, and now it wants to push the edges into new technologies.
This really has very serious implications for privacy and for our innovative edge. And it also has implications for security, because if you build vulnerabilities into these technologies, it's not going to be long before the hackers find a way to exploit them.
So far, the details of the proposal are sketchy. The FBI says the plan would only cover investigations where they got a subpoena or a search warrant approved by a judge. And they say they don't want any sweeping new authority. Dempsey disagrees.
They want clearly new authority. That's why they're talking about legislation. They're talking about the authority, in essence, to control the design of new services.
Jaffer, the Bush Justice Department official, says this is only the start of a conversation about helping the law keep up with technology.
Congress has an important role to play here, and think about how to balance privacy on one hand and security and safety of its citizens on the other.
The last time Congress waded into these issues, it took years for new legislation. Police say they're hoping they don't have to wait so long this time. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.